Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 26, To Your Online Health.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hi all, this is Denise Howell, and welcome to This Week in Law, episode 26. We're doing a cool, kind of different episode today because it's something I've wanted to probe for a long time, and I've put together a panel who I hope will help us do that in a very effective way. And the subject that I wanted to cover with these wonderful folks is online healthcare. So we've got together with us today Bob Caulfield, who is a healthcare lawyer who also is a blogger and provides great information on his blog at, isn't it Healthcare Blog Law?
It's Healthcare Blog Law Blogspot.
Blogspot.com. So great to have you here, Bob. Also with us is Susanna Fox.
Hey.
From the Pew Internet Life Project. And I'm going to have Susanna and Bob and Doc Searles, who is our third guest, talk to you a bit more about their backgrounds as they are all new guests to TWiL. Here's Doc. Doc, great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Denise.
I've been following closely along with Project VRM, Vendor Relationship Management, and your recent post to Linux Journal on that topic. Doc, why don't you start off and give us a bit more about your background and your interest in vendor relationship management as it pertains to healthcare? And then we'll do the same for each of our other panelists and be off and running.
Well, since I'm turning 62 years old this month, I have way too much background. And so I'll try to compress that as much as possible. I've been writing for Linux Journal for many years. I've been covering open source one way or another since the early 90s. I'm a senior editor with Linux Journal, meaning I'm the oldest editor on staff, probably the least technical as well. With the three other guys, I co-wrote the Kutrin Manifesto in 1999, came out in 2000. The new edition just came out. In fact, it's in bookstores now, which includes like seven new chapters on various things. My chapter has to do with VRM, which is my project at the Berkman Center at Harvard, where I've been a fellow for the last 3 years and going into my fourth year this summer. Project VRM works to equip customers or individuals with tools to manage their relationships with vendors. What we've had since industry won the Industrial Revolution is a system in which the vendors, the sell side, the suppliers, that could be the hospitals, it could be anybody that's in a position of control, really controls the relationships. And it's fractured our lives enormously. And probably nowhere more than in healthcare. And it turns out that helping patients manage their relationships with the healthcare system is one VRM area that's been under a lot of development already for a number of years. I saw that Health 2.0, an event in Boston earlier this year, was called Patient-Driven Healthcare. That's about as VRM as it gets. I'm less involved in the healthcare side of it, in part because I hate to say it. I'd like to see some stuff solved in my lifetime, and I'm not sure that will be. But where I've concentrated most is on bringing a new business model to public radio, and even to things like this. So that's probably the most compressed version of it.
Great. Susanna, why don't you bring us up to speed with your work at Pew?
Okay, great. The Pew Internet Project is a nonprofit research organization. We're funded by the Pew Charitable Trust, which you may have heard of, but I wanted to let everybody know that the money comes from 19th century Pennsylvania oil. It has nothing to do with technology. We study the social impact of the internet, and what I focus on these days mostly is the internet's impact on healthcare. And I also blog at a website called epatients.net. And the concept that's come out of that blog is called participatory medicine, which is basically another word for health 2.0, and is the idea that patients can be partners in their care with doctors. And it's very much wrapped up in the idea of health data rights and people accessing what I call industrial strength information, not just consumer strength information.
Great. And on the subject of healthcare rights and what the law provides, we also have Bob Caulfield, our healthcare lawyer, on the panel. Bob, why don't you give us a bit of your background and how it jibes with the issue of online health records and management?
Thanks, Denise. I'm a healthcare lawyer with Flaherty Sitzball Vanasso in Charleston, West Virginia, and I've been practicing since the early 90s. I started out with a state agency, moved over into the healthcare environment mid-90s, and that agency was responsible for data, health data repository for the state. I then moved back into private practice and have been involved and have a general healthcare practice here in West Virginia that expands. I started blogging pretty early, 2004. And as a result of that, became involved in a lot of the healthcare blogging network. That's really where I first met you, and then also a number of the early health bloggers. As a result of that, I met Matthew Holt, and we actually sat on one of the early panels. Those of you who may not know Matthew, he is one of the founders of the Health 2.0 that Doc mentioned earlier about the conference in Boston. They have an annual meeting, and I've been following along on really the developments both in healthcare, regulatory law, and the involvement with technology since then. I've migrated my practice more in that direction. I still have a pretty traditional, what I would say, traditional healthcare industry practice here in West Virginia that really spans the breadth of regulatory work, transactional work, and some litigation, administrative litigation. So that's kind of quick summary of my background.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning with healthcare 2.0. Can you guys define that for me and tell me what its goals are and where we're headed with online healthcare and patient-centric health management?
You know, I'll jump in. It's a developing definition, I think, that we've seen over the last number of years. There's a traditional view that it is a very tight view of it as being really lightweight tools, web-based tools, which replace in large part a lot of the traditional software and information systems that are out there. Merging into that, and it really started out, I think, with health search and then has slowly grown into a number of other sectors. You've also seen the play in of really the participatory medicine side and the consumer driven side, which has been a piece of it really all along. And I view it as a vehicle that we have to use in our current healthcare industry to bring about the changes that need to happen from a cost standpoint, from improved care and improved quality. I'll let the Susanna and Doc follow up with that.
Well, I would say that Bob has defined it perfectly. If you're looking at Health 2.0, then it really does focus on the technology and the idea of user-generated content in health and these lightweight applications. But going back further, the history of this actually goes back to the Whole Earth Catalog, where people were able to start to do more self-care and take control of their health by doing more home health care. And that's why when we talk about e-patients, the E, most people think it stands for electronic, but it's actually engaged and empowered. And of course, the internet has helped people to expand their toolbox and do all sorts of things that people in the 70s couldn't dream of. But that's why bringing in the idea of participatory medicine to Health 2.0 kind of brings in that history.
So, Doc, you've been having some firsthand experiences with our healthcare system lately, and voicing your thoughts on those experiences quite eloquently. And the more I read about what you've gone through and the insights you've shared, the more I feel like there is so much work to do. Can you sort of start us out from your perspective of where that work should start and whether we're making any progress at all?
Okay. Yes. I should say it isn't lately. I had a couple of encounters with hospitalization over a year ago, and I'm fine now. There was a medical procedure that went bad, and I ended up with pancreatitis and found out a little bit too much about how the sausage is made or cared for or whatever else you might say. I think the system is terribly broken. I'm not sure that 2.0 gets us there either. I'll be a little bit blunt here. I love everything we're trying to do with Health 2.0, with engaging the patient and the rest of it. But the main problem is there's an awful lot of bad data out there. There's horrible data management. There is no culture of openness, or very little culture of openness on the supply side of the big medical equipment manufacturers, the pharma companies, the Keretsus of relationships between hospitals and the list goes on and on. I mean, I'm in a really good healthcare system with Harvard. Okay, they're terrific. The doctors are outstanding. Getting an MRI from one hospital to another, from the hospital to my own doctor, from that doctor to another doctor, to get it looked at by a second party, getting it even to come up on the beat up old PC that my gastroenterologist has, is an ordeal. I mean, there are cases where I have to go to another hospital and pick up a CD. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not. When I started with Harvard healthcare, I had to bring together something like, 19 different sources of data from prior medical, from Kaiser here and from some other hospital there. I mean, when I had my spleen out when I was 12, with the rest of it, the interesting thing is that a lot of it got faxed. Almost a lot of it's illegible. I mean, it's a complete and utter mess. And people die of bad data. My mother died of bad data. I mean, there's the list can go on and on. I think that the patient, the individual, needs to be the point of integration for their own data. And that's not just in healthcare, it's in everything. And because they are the responsible party ultimately. And then they need to be the point of origination about what gets done with that data. And we need a system or a set of systems that wants that to happen. I don't think most of the talk I've heard about Health 2.0 quite gets there yet. I think there's a 3.0 stage in which the patient really is in charge of their data. And I also think in the long run, we need a system where the respect for data does not involve games around risk. I think that a logical problem that we have is that we have a system that's based on calculations about risk in a world in which we're sitting in a sea of bits where the amount of that could be known about a patient by a system is very high. And as long as we're fearing risk inside of that, we have an incentive to obscure facts. And that is going to kill people. And I think that's part of the problem.
Another part of the problem, it strikes me, is the logical and rational concern about the security of healthcare data and laws like HIPAA that tightly control how information can be shared. On the one hand, you need to have information be freely accessible, centralized, as easy for me to get to as my email now is with Gmail, right? So Google Health and encouraging development. But at the same time, it seems like, as you were saying, Doc, there's a lot of barriers in place to getting to that kind of a situation. Bob Caulfield, do you have any thoughts on how the law is helping or hindering this process?
Yeah, we're really in a disruptive phase right now. Susanna and I both just finished testifying in front of the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics on the future of PHRs. And one of the things in kind of preparing this week, I was reading about docs.
Define your acronym there. That's personal health records, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's personal health records, which is a shift from the traditional notion that health information is typically stored at the provider level, at the payer level, at your doctor's office, at the hospital, or at your local insurance company. The personal health record becomes a vehicle, a new platform, as I think Doc referred to it, as patients being a platform. And PHRs may be that vehicle for the future, where we centralize data back on you and I as the central location for our own health information. Susanna and I just, as I was saying, finished up testifying there. And I think we are in the very early stages of the real birth of this PHR, Google Health and Microsoft Health Vault being two of the technologies out there that are being used. I think what will occur is that consumers, if they become engaged, will start to populate those PHRs themselves with information, which may, in some sense, shift the traditional relationship that you and I have with our healthcare provider. We start to bring more information to our physician when we come to the office. Instead of bringing a ream of paper about my particular condition that I've searched and hand that over to my doctor, I'm instead going to bring my information through a PHR. That's going to be a big change because traditionally in the healthcare industry, those records and that siloed information is very valuable. As we all know, that data, at least some believe, is very valuable kept separate. I think the goal is to start to share that. The other impact that's playing into this is really what happened in February with the new stimulus bill and the high-tech provisions that came out underneath that. What's coming out is this $20 billion, which is going to be used for health technology. And the question over the next couple years is going to be how that's going to be implemented. One of the definitions that comes out is the meaningful use of health information technology. And that's going to be that's the defined term for whether a particular physician is then going to receive funding for its own EMR or if we move to a PHR model of some sort.
And I'll jump in and just add that one of my favorite questions around meaningful use is it meaningful if a patient can't use it? And that, to me, has been, it's basically become a rallying cry among people who really believe that consumers should have access to their health records, should be able to see what the doctor writes, to view their test results. And as Doc said, people die from bad data. And so why not invite the people who care the most about having accurate data about them, the patients and caregivers, invite them in. The other thing I love, and here I'm quoting ePatient Dave, is you know how you clean up your house right before you have guests? Well, if patients were going to see the records, then doctors would probably start to clean up a little bit and make sure that they're accurate.
So explain to me how this would work, because I'm having trouble coming up with another analogy where the data breadcrumbs that we leave behind in our lives are, in fact, adequately compartmentalized and easily accessible when we need them, other than, as I mentioned a minute ago, my Gmail account, which seems to work well. When I think about things like employment history, tax history, all of these various important data points in our lives, they're still locked in either a paper world or a fragmented electronic world, much like medical records are. So how would this personal health record actually function? Or are people still figuring that out?
I think we're still figuring it out. And I don't know whether it is going to work. I don't know whether consumers are going to become engaged enough. You know, one of the things we're going to fight in this shift over, and we are, is, and one of the underlying issues is the whole reimbursement for healthcare. we have been built in the United States to recognize that cost doesn't matter. We don't ask about cost when we go in, and there's not necessarily an engaged consumer that is there. I know that Susanna can talk a little more about what some of her statistics that she's finding out in that area. You know, as an analogy, you know, I hear as an analogy the banking industry, although I think it has moved along a little further, but you're right that even those breadcrumbs in the banking industry have not necessarily been aggregated in one location with a systematic location. One of the things that ePatient Dave, who Susanna mentioned, and I testified both about was we use this model of the PHR at this point being the Model T stage. We are really in the elementary stages of the automobile industry with PHRs, and we can only envision where that may take us if we look back over the last 60 years for the automobile industry and the changes that occurred, shifting from a system at that point, which was largely based on a rail system, to the personal vehicles that automobiles brought and the freedom that those brought. And that may be another analogy we may want to look at in trying to compare that to the changeover that we're experiencing right now with health data.
And I love that analogy. I love the Model T analogy. And you can just imagine how strange it must have been to try and think about how to regulate, you know, the new roadways and how can we see into the future about how these things are going to be used until they're more fully developed. In terms of consumer engagement on this, what we see is that there is a really high interest among Americans to look for health information online. That's kind of the 1.0 level of searching for health information, to prepare for a doctor's appointment, to recover from a doctor's appointment, just to check something out online. But there are fewer people who are actually posting any content to the web related to health. It's about 20% of internet users at this point who are really engaging in a more active way. And by the way, that fits with most activities. People who are interested are going to be especially engaged. So people with a chronic condition are more engaged than someone who's going along with their life very well and healthy, and they don't need a lot of health information. So, you know, it is a question also for PHRs. Who's going to populate all the data? Where's the data going to come from? I know people who have created electronic medical records from scratch, and it takes a long time. And one thing that is parallel to the banking industry, one reason the banking industry got really excited about online banking is that it makes them very sticky. Once somebody has dealt with creating the account and all the passwords, they are very likely to stick with that bank. Banks are basically reporting that people who have an online account with them are more likely just to stay with them for years and not switch. Is that something we're going to see with electronic medical records? Or are people going to be allowed to move around as healthdatarights.org has advocated?
Doc, have you moved down the road at all of putting any of your healthcare information online to try and deal with this problem?
Yeah, I've moved a short distance down the road. The interesting thing is that I would like to be able to have access to the stuff that Harvard collected when I sent out these forms, or had them send out these forms to prior healthcare providers so I could put the pieces back together. The problem there is that even if you, and I don't know who's had experience with this, but it's an interesting thing. Try walking into a doctor's office with your own complete medical history written up by hand or typed out or printed out. They still want to get an oral thing. There's some legal reason for that. Maybe Bob, you could fill us in with that. There's some problem with the patient walking in, trying to be the source, the primary source of information, on their own terms. The way the system is rigged still, we're trying to run cars on railroads. I think that's an absolutely fabulous analogy. The thing is that, you know, we need an invention that mutters necessity here. And the invention, I don't think yet, is the PHR. I think that as long as we're trying to do cars on railroads, we will have, we'll continue to have the same kind of problems. So I'm encouraged by the whole PHR discussion. I'm encouraged by the fact that these large companies have stepped up, but I think what we need are substitutable services, and a lot of them. So it should be really easy to move your data from Google Health to Microsoft Health Vault. And maybe it is, and I don't know. I suspect it's not, actually. It may be daunting in that respect. It's relatively easy, actually, to move your money from one place to another. And I'm interested, I'm actually kind of surprised by the news that banks are sticky in that respect. Because my experience with banks, Chase separate from WaMu, and then WaMu went into Chapelev, that was my bank, and now Chase owns them. And it's impossible to do business with them online. It's so daunting. And so, I mean, I have a bookkeeper and a tax guy. Neither one of them can figure out how to make things happen online with those banks. So now that bank. So I don't know. I think we're still sort of at the horse and buggy stage, and we still need a car.
Denise, I'll follow up. Just, you know, there's been a real change over what I'll say is that when we talk about the medical file, or your health file, that's also a medical legal file. And it was interesting. I was talking to one of my partners who's a med mal lawyer, medical malpractice lawyer, and he has lived through the kind of growth of the medical malpractice over the last 25 years. And we were talking about what he viewed as the record prior to really the start of that. And he said there was very little documentation that was done. In large part, a lot of the documentation that you now find in your file is done for legal purposes. And it's really negative documentation, whether a certain procedure was done and how it was done to confirm the negatives, rather than what really is important for you and I as the patient, which is the diagnosis and the forward-looking, the positive-looking features of what our healthcare is. So we need to look at that record as serving multiple purposes. And that's one of the reasons why I think, as Doc faced the question of bringing in your own documentation into the file, there's a psychological sense to that for the provider side, as to thinking how that may be used to harm them in litigation in the future, or how it may be negatively used against them.
Well, one of the things Doc has talked about is that we're at the beginning of a stage where if we're able to have a free and open health infrastructure, then countless new businesses and services could grow on top of this notion as of patient in the center, patient as a platform. So it strikes me that one thing we would certainly need is a way to sift that information. You know, what is important for the patient as far as diagnostic concerns, health maintenance concerns, and what is simply chaff that's put there as insurance against some future malpractice claim by the doctor. Is it way too early to see that there might be this market of health assistants springing up out there to help manage one's electronic health data? Or is that actually happening?
I don't know. It's a good question. In thinking about my own... seeing my own medical record and my kids' medical record, because, I mean, I am my children's medical assistant. Sure. It's something that you have to manage. And I've heard stories of pediatric clinics all over the country and people who have this little blue book that you're given at your child's birth, where you start
to report,
right? Where you get a stamp in it, like a passport, when you get your immunization. And so then no matter where you go, you've got this little print book. And it was such an anachronism when somebody handed it to me. I was like, What is this? Why are you handing me this folded up brochure? It turned out to be something that really sticks with people. So, the research that we've done has shown that people are ready for this. People are ready to manage this kind of data. People are going to be really interested to make sure that it's accurate. I don't think everybody's going to be ready at the beginning, but I think that certainly I know a lot of parents who are already living this, and there's a lot of kids who are living this, children who have aging parents who are doing this on behalf of their elders, who also have this sense of responsibility, and why not open it up so that we can be sure that everything is accurate?
Well, the security and privacy issues are out there as one reason why folks would be reluctant to have all of their medical information put online. I mean, my doctor is very progressive in her use of electronic health records for her own office. And, you know, she walks around with her little tablet PC and can pull up anything in my health history from years back and can do prescriptions for me on the fly right there on her tablet. And it's all very impressive, but none of it is accessible by me and none of it is on the interwebs, which, you know, I mean, in the other room of our house here, my son has a little fish tank terrarium full of frogs that is as tightly sealed as it can be and enable them to breathe. And I don't know how, but one of them, Houdini, like, manages invariably to get out, and we're chasing it all over the house. And I'm wondering if there is any way to keep online health records as secure as they would need to be, and maybe taking as a given that it's not. Is that a situation that people can deal with and are ready to deal with? What do you guys think?
You know, we talked a little bit about HIPAA, and HIPAA came into effect in 2003, and we've now seen the first real revision of it with the new high-tech provisions. It was a first stage to really develop a national standard or platform for data privacy, health data privacy nationally. Before that, we had really a patchwork of state laws that varied, and if you were a provider providing services across multiple states, then it was difficult to manage those. It did not totally preempt state law, and that's one of the problems. We still do not have just one standard. You not only have to meet the federal standard, but you also have to meet the various state standards. You know, the privacy question, and there are a lot of different angles you can take from that. You know, I do not think, like your frog, we cannot keep the cover on the privacy issue. There are going to be data breaches. There is going to be an industry standard that's out there. With the new high-tech provisions, we now have the first federal breach notification requirement that overlaps on all the state data breach. So that's going to be a protection to at least notify you and I when someone does breach that data, whether they met the standard or not, it's notification. The other factor that I think plays into this is, and I'd be interested to hear Susanna's kind of survey statistics on this, but the background as to why people consider health data important or to be kept private. And I suspect one of the main reasons is that it's not used inappropriately by your employer. And that's a product of employer-based health insurance. There's this close tie and relationship between how we have always received payment or how the payment for our healthcare has been managed through our employer. That's kind of at a disconnect with this fact that we never want our employer to know what those health conditions that we may have. As we move to this world of genetic information, I think that becomes even a bigger, a larger question that we're going to have to face down the road. If my provider can know and my employer can know, or anyone else, if my data gets out there, that I'm going to suffer a heart attack in the next 10 years, or predisposed for cancer or some other condition. Those may be factors where I think the privacy level, and we're at this stage where privacy with the whole social media movement, I'm not sure where the levels of privacy sit at this point. I think it's in flux, and we may see a backlash from that to some extent as we move down this road to more open communication via social media.
Well, I've definitely have seen surveys that people rank their health data up with their financial data in terms of wanting to keep it private. But here I'm actually going to cite one of my favorite law professors is at George Washington University, Daniel Solov. And he wrote an article, and it's also part of a book that he's written about the taxonomy of the word privacy in a legal sense. And because I think with user-generated content, I think one of the key points that he might make is that we're actually talking about confidentiality and anonymity. Because I think some of the most exciting experiments that are happening right now in Health 2.0 are sites like Patients Like Me, where people can create a profile and they don't have to use their real name or have anything that identifies them. And they can track all of their medications, all of their symptoms, their moods, their weight, everything that matters to them about their health, and share it with other people. And the data is aggregated so that other people with the same condition can share and learn from each other. That has nothing to do with electronic medical records, frankly. It's something that they control. They're tracking this for themselves. And so it's absolutely, you know, that is the point of integration, that patient. And they then can take all of this incredibly rich data to their health professionals, but they own it. They're the ones who are creating it. They're the ones who are getting the benefit. And by the way, so are their doctors once they get to see, you know, oh, so maybe I should dial back that medication because you're having these symptoms 3 hours after you take it. That's incredibly powerful. And it goes to the idea of anonymity, that you can track this stuff totally anonymously.
Doc, what do you think of the privacy issues? Is it the old, you have no privacy anyway, get over it? Or is there a way to actually have some faith in the net being able to secure our data?
Well, I don't think the net secures our data. In fact, I think the net is the biggest data exposure system ever created in the world. So we need to come along with follow-up systems that allow us to be selective about what we disclose. In general, in the field, this is known as selective disclosure. Within the VRM community, there are some really good people, especially in the UK, working on something called VPI for Volunteer Personal Information. Also with colleagues at the Berkman Center and around Project VRM and within Harvard Law School, for that matter, and other places like it, we're talking about coming up with terms of engagement that completely flip around what we're used to encountering. What we're used to encountering is terms of service that we have no choice but to accept and put all advantages and locate all advantages on the sell side or on the provider side. I mean, how many times have we said accept or okay to terms of service that we've never read and we never are going to read because there's no point in reading it if we want the service. These are coercive. They've been copied and pasted since probably Amazon and Netscape did the first ones in 1995, never been deeply examined. What if we turn that around, however, where so the terms of use of confidentiality, as Bob put it, of anonymity, if we're being aggregated, as Samantha put it, is under our control, that would be a wonderful thing. All of that said, and I think we have a lot of work to do there, I think privacy is a bit of a red herring. It's a distraction. It's important. I'm not saying it's not, but I think we get hung up on it. I think the real issue, as I said before, is a system in which the risk of exposure and fear about the risk of exposure to in a system that is all built around risk rather than care exceeds the benefits of disclosure in order to get good healthcare. I've changed jobs and I've changed healthcare providers so many times, and every single time it's all about pre-existing conditions. What are the risks around those things? I'm at a point in my life right now where I really don't care what people know about me, honestly. What I want to get is not just good healthcare, but but while I love patients like me and I think it's a fabulous thing, there is no other patient just like me. As Bob pointed out, as our genetic information becomes available and more fully understood, many, many, many medical conditions are combinations of things. The minor blood disorder that my sister and I both have is shared by literally dozens of people worldwide. All of them are different. All of them interact in different ways with medicines, with drugs, with modes of care, with different procedures that can be conducted. I'm convinced of the problem that I had with the GI thing that went bad over a year ago had to do with not knowing how I interact with this or that. We need to be able to expose as much as possible of ourselves to people who are in a position to do useful things with that information that are not us. Okay. But we need to be in control of that. I think as long as we have a system in which we have to keep people in business who calculate risk for a living, and as long as risk remains a central cornerstone to the economic as well as the operational system of healthcare, we're kind of screwed.
Bob and Susanna, you guys just testified in Washington. Is there anything coming down the pipe we should know about that you know about that has to do with charting our forward course and any legislation that may be coming and any earmarking of these stimulus funds?
Bob, I hope you can take that one.
I found it very positive that at least the Office of National Coordinator, as a part of the testimony that we participated in, are looking to the future of this consumer-driven healthcare side. I think this pace with which technology and healthcare is moving at this stage, I think it's one of the difficulties is going to be whether government is going to be satisfied and be able to capable of keeping up with the pace that's going to occur in the industry. I know there was a post today by ETH patient Dave out there talking about the amounts that are going to be saved by some of the large groups that have come forward to say we're going to help to save over the next 10 years a certain amount. Those changes are going to happen faster, and clearly the Office of National Coordinator is going to have $20 billion to hand out. And so there are going to be the financial basis is there for some pretty substantial changes from a technology standpoint. My concern is that those same changes do not occur from a user standpoint and a process standpoint, in the sense that if we have a broken process and we just pile on additional technology, that's not going to help the process. We've got to look at the underlying process and change that, whether it be reimbursement, whether it be the relationship between provider and patient, whether it be the data ownership issue and who controls that ownership of information. All of those are going to play into it. So, I mean, it's an exciting time for healthcare in D.C. It's an exciting time for the industry. It's interesting to sit back and view this. I know Esther Dyson used last year, the year before at the Health 2.0 conference, the vision of the traditional healthcare industry being a hairball, and that the Health 2.0 world and a lot of the things that are happening out there in what I'll consider to be the non-traditional healthcare environment is going to be real interesting to watch over the next few years and how the government reacts to that.
Do you guys think that the government and the medical establishment are listening to and being affected by all of the two-way conversations that are being enabled by the web and various real-time discussions like the one we're having right now, that they are being held more accountable and are needing to respond in ways that they may not have in the past?
I think it depends on the agency. I've seen some really really interesting things coming out of the CDC related to the H1N1 flu virus. I've also had some great conversations with people who are more on the career side for HHS, who are really excited about the possibilities for public health and messaging that they can take advantage of, the interwebs. And also, I mean, the White House, we've seen some amazing beginnings, frankly. We don't know where it's going to lead, but data.gov, I think, is a really interesting step into exposing the inner workings and data. I'd love to see what people can do to mash up that data and show us from both sides of the aisle the pros and cons of what's going on. So, I mean, I do think there's some real positive developments. But then again, I was on a panel last week, and it was supposed to be a panel about participatory medicine and how technology can revolutionize healthcare the way it revolutionized politics during last year's campaign. A member of the panel was Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat from New York, and he essentially didn't want to talk about technology. He wanted to talk about the politics of healthcare reform, and the discussion really went off the rails, and there was actually a moment when somebody from the audience stood up and asked, you know, does anybody consider the possibility of open source being able to solve some of the health data questions? And it was one of those moments where it was so clear that the question and frankly the policymakers weren't even transmitting on the same frequency. The conversation has not begun in that sense.
Doc, what do you think about that? Do you think the future of health infrastructure will be built on an open source kind of model?
Well, I think it has to be. I think the I think we need to qualify that as well, though. I mean, open source began as a development methodology, and now it's a kind of blanket statement that generally means a pile of things, including transparency, for example. I think we need to pull those apart a little bit. But the question that flummoxed the hearing there is a perfectly obvious example of how far we need to go here. I think that what we have right now, and again, we could go back to the railroad analogy, is that we're back at the Victorian stage. We're still at horse and buggies. We know we need cars, and we've already got railroads, and we're busy understanding everything in terms of railroads. Remember they called the railroad the iron horse, right? It wasn't. And the internet is not the information superhighway either. Craig Burton, who I know you and I know both know, Denise, who was responsible really, I think, more than anybody else for the success of Novell back in the 80s. He refers to the internet as a giant empty sphere. I call it a giant zero. It tends to put everybody at zero distance from everybody else. It pushes costs towards zero. It's a very, very simple system of protocols that is essentially open. And we have to deal with that to begin with and see that as a positive thing. It has profound implications for everything. We don't have the social systems to deal with it yet. I think that the term social showing up so much right now in Web 2.0 and the stuff that we're talking about in respect to the net just begins to point at a lot of the problems that we have with, for example, exposure. Kevin Kelly says the internet is a big copy machine. It's a It's a profoundly important insight. When you send me an email, you don't lose that email. I gain it. You don't lose it. The nature of the net is to proliferate data. We live on what Bob Frankston, who's the co-inventor of the spreadsheet, calls a sea of bits. And the old systems want to make parts of that sea scarce. We want to build canals across the ocean. And a lot of things are absolutely obsoleted by the fact that the net is in the middle of them. And I think I've gone over it already, probably too much, but I think that the base assumptions that we begin with healthcare are just not suited for a world in which we are all zero distance from each other. There are zero costs involved. There's maximum responsibility on the individual's part. There's changed responsibility on providers' parts. There's a need to relate very differently between institutions and between individuals. The law is a huge, probably an asset and a huge problem here. As long as malpractice remains as onerous a thing for doctors as it is. I know two doctors, really good doctors. One quit the business. Another one was really damaged by a lawsuit that he considered wrong. And yet at the same time, the doctor who was in charge of who basically used the bad data that ended my mother's life, turned in his license a couple of weeks ago. And I felt really good about that. So who knows? I think the older I get, the closer to the beginning I think we are.
Bob, on the malpractice front, is the specter of malpractice and the sort of culture of risk that we live in the medical establishment, is that something that is a big barrier to moving forward with personal health records and online health information management in general? I mean, would doctors just prefer that stuff remained difficult to find?
Yeah, I mean, it is going to be disruptive to the kind of traditional way that we've looked at medical malpractice, and certainly doctors are concerned about what data they have to view. You know, one of the interesting things that's developing in this whole area is, you know, based on the standard of care, you know, is there a duty on the doctor, I think, to go out and look at this information that may be saved in a PHR? Is there a duty to go out and query? For example, there's a company called Sermo, which is really almost to some extent a Facebook for physicians. It's physician only. It allows a physician to go out and query the other physicians about a particular condition or that someone may have. You know, does the standard of care now require some of that to occur? Mm-hmm. So I think there are a number of places that play in. The other large impact that it has is really on the discovery process and how data that is not housed anymore just at the doctor's office may be used in the context of the discovery process. There was a interesting case out of New Jersey that I use as an example in some of the presentations I do that involved an insurance coverage question where a minor who was being treated for an eating disorder, the question was hinged on whether the coverage, the insurance coverage, if it was psychological, then it was not covered, but if it was medical, then it was covered. And they sought out discovery from Facebook posts that she had put up on Facebook as a product of the malpractice of the underlying case. So those types of examples are going to come up more and more as we see this progress. And, you know, as data moves around and flows around and is stored in different locations, it becomes more difficult, not only from the physician standpoint, to understand what they have to look at in the context of accurately diagnosing or treating a particular patient, but also from the side of the discovery process.
Have there been cases on that where a doctor has been held not to have met the standard of care because he or she did not adequately go out and investigate third-party sources that, you know, perhaps on a patients like me site where they could have gathered anonymous data that would have been outside the usual medical infrastructure?
I have not seen a reported case along those lines. I suspect some of those things are being tested. Pretty much all I'm seeing at this point, and there's very little written case law yet, you know, I'm seeing some news reports and those sorts of things. So I am not aware of one of those. If any listeners are out there are aware of those, I'd love to know what they are.
Great. Well, Doc, what do you think? You know, the Clue Train Manifesto has just taken its 10th year down the tracks. And do you think that the health industry is answering these calls, or is there just so much more work to do there that they should go out and immediately read your book?
Well, I'm not sure what difference between the book will make, although I'd like people to read the book. I think that the answer to the question is both. I think that we've got an awful long way to go. But the interesting thing to me about healthcare is that there is more work being done there in the relationship management area than anywhere else, especially here in the U.S., where I think we can all agree our healthcare system is more at least complex, if not outright screwed up, than it is anywhere else in the world. I think in many ways we have the best care. I also think we have the most complicated care. And I think that we are, you know, at this point of maximal disruption. And I just love it that there are so many really, really good people and really dedicated people who are selflessly working on something that's going to take years, if not decades, or a century, if you look at it in terms of railroads, to solve. So I'm optimistic about that. But I think the larger trend that's going to go on, and I think that healthcare is going to be a very big part of it, is not so much a shift in responsibility from supply to demand, but the enabling of the demand side to drive what happens on the supply side. And healthcare is a huge part of that. But it's going to involve many, many other things. We're going to see it in retail. We're going to see it in education. We're certainly seeing it in government. There's so many people working on that as well. I think that we're dealing with by far the most enlightened administration that we've ever had in respect to the importance of the digital world, if not many other topics as well. So I'm encouraged about that. But I also have a great deal of faith in politics as usual. So I don't know. Again, I think it's going to take a long time, and I'm glad that as much progress is being made as is actually going on.
Well, one of my favorite lines from the newly released Clue Train came from you, Doc, and it was, I can't be bought, but I can be paid. So I'm going to use that as our segue into talking about our wonderful sponsor, Audible.com. Who has been a sponsor of This Week in Law from the very get-go. And what we do is try and give a recommendation for you to go ahead and use your free book that you can get when you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill. And the one that I've picked out for this show is called The Lifestyle Lowdown, A Simpler Life. It's by Lucy McCaraher and Annabelle Shaw, narrated by Lorelei King. And it sounds a bit self-helpy for something that I would generally use, but I think that it goes along great with the theme of our show tries to encourage people to get off the go treadmill and consider if there's a simpler, more satisfying way to live. And I think what we've been talking about today is a simpler, more satisfying healthcare system that we'd all like to be working toward, particularly with regard to our own medical records. So this seems like a good fit for our show, and I encourage people to go out and check out The Lifestyle Lowdown, A Simpler Life, at audible.com. And you can also follow Audible on Twitter, twitter.com/audible_com. So thanks so much, Audible, for sponsoring the show. And one thing I wanted to get into that Doc had sent my way before the show that has nothing to do with healthcare, but has everything to do with an area that Doc has been involved in for a long, long time, is Pandora and Sound Exchange and some of the topics we more regularly cover on This Week in Law. Doc, can you bring us up to speed on what has been happening there?
Right. So there's a new piece of legislation, or not even legislation. I actually have a little PDF here. The Webcaster Settlement Act of 2009. As many of you know, something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of the DMCA was passed in 1998. Among the unfinished things there was something that had language very close to this, that in the absence of a willing buyer and a willing seller, the category we call radio, but they called webcasting or performance, they had several different ways that they put it, would have to be settled between copyright holders and the radio stations on the net. And very long story, very short, this has gone through a number of stages over the last decade, the most recent of which, each of which, by the way, had all of the broadcasters crying out for mercy and all of the record company executives saying, right on, we got what we wanted out of this. The latest is one that creates a new category for the likes of Pandora and Last.fm and other services that are not radio in the usual sense, but just stream music on demand. And it's been very interesting to watch this, because I think what's going on is that the RIAA and Sound Exchange, which is essentially their collection agency, have done a really good job of splitting the opposition and making it so labyrinthine and difficult that and really punitive for anybody wanting to be in the business of broadcasting music online, that it's going to, if not strangle the industry, it's certainly going to slow it down enormously. It's already done that. But on the upside, I think that it's going to be solvable to some degree, because we at the VRM community have come up with something that we think is a pretty cool new business model based on something called Emancipate, that'll make it possible for anybody to pay anything they want for anything they hear on the radio, or for that matter, read in a newspaper or read online. Could be a blog, could be this podcast. There'll be a little button that looks like a red thing like this, and there are two of them together, mean we've got a relationship going on, two of them apart, mean we don't quite have it yet. You click on it here, say, you know what, I want to throw a couple bucks at Denise or Leo or whoever, or just I want to pledge something. Make it as easy as possible to pay whatever you want for whatever you
have
want.
Have you seen Kachingle?
I have seen Kachingle, and I don't want to knock anybody who's doing good work, and I think they're doing good work here. What we want to do is something that is not an intermediary. They're an intermediary. You have to kind of belong to Kachingle, and they have their own little private symbol you can put on your website and collect money through that. That's cool. But what we want to do is have something that's universal, that's as simple to understand as like a little lock or a little symbol that means expand or contract, or this means answer the phone. Here's one that means, hey, I want to relate to this particular podcast. I want to relate to this particular artist. Or I want to have a policy of paying a penny a song and then have somebody, some intermediary step up and have a whole category of intermediaries that can step up and help out, say, you know, help you escrow the money, help you escrow the intentions, help you log what you've been listening to, all the rest of that. But we're trying to create the open standards and the open protocols and the open symbology for doing this kind of thing, because we think what's going to happen in the long run, as users get more independence and users are more in charge of the relationships and users are more able to initiate contact and initiate the terms of engagement, that they're going to need tools for doing this that are open and standard and easy for anybody to use and any number of industries to grow on top of them.
So what's the progress on that? Is it something that's just in the development stages right now?
I'd say it is in the development stages. I wouldn't say just in the development stages. There's growing interest in it. We have to be really careful in how we do it, because we don't want to threaten existing business models, especially, say, for public radio, which has been very supportive and very involved. There's for those of you with iPhones, I encourage downloading the free public radio tuner. Hopefully that will be the first place that you'll see some of this stuff going on. We're going to work on first on logging. And that'll be logging of what you've been listening to by you, for you, not by others for their purposes. This is a big switch from what we're used to seeing. There are people working on unscrewing the loyalty card business. Loyalty cards are insane. They're the green stamps of our time. They slow things down at the cash register. They require keeping multiple pricing structures. The amount of data they collect and what's actually done with the data is unclear and probably not very well done in any case. You get a little thing on the back of your receipt that says you have a discount now for the thing you just bought. What good is that, right? So, you know, why should we carry around all these barcodes that are given to us by other people? I have many relationships in the world. I want to be in control of those. How do I do that? So we have people working on completely inverting the loyalty card system so that I have one card or I have one form of relating and I'll tell you how I want to relate. Or I'd like to give you my shopping list as I come in the store. If you got it, great. If you don't, well, at least you knew I wanted it, right? So that, you know, turning all that around is really, to me, like the unfinished business of Clue Trade. It's the thing that we didn't quite get done. And that's one reason why I wrote the chapter that I did in the new issue. It's about, you know, Chris Locke had this statement in the first Clue Train that was so right on and implied so much. He said, "We are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it." So the grasp is still there and the reach has not arrived yet. And so that's what we're working on.
Well, it seems like that all ties in very well with the healthcare considerations we were discussing earlier as well, that you should be able to just walk into a doctor's office or a hospital when you require care and give them your VRM friendly equivalent of the loyalty card that has the information that you want shared available, and the doctor takes it from there. But it does seem like we're a long way from when that will happen. Another facet of all this that we've sort of touched on but not tackled directly yet in our conversation, we talked about two-way conversations and the industry being held accountable. Susanna and Bob, before we wrap things up today, I wanted to get your thoughts, and you too, Doc, of course, on rating sites, particularly as regard to healthcare. And what role these things are playing and how doctors are responding to them. Susanna, you want to go first?
Sure. So we did a survey in December, and we just released the data in a report called The Social Life of Health Information. And we asked people all sorts of questions about how they get health information and how they gather it, how they share it. And one of the things we found is that about half of internet users have looked up doctor information. They've actually done a search for a doctor's name or started a search. So people are definitely interested in doing this kind of consumer research. And we found that about 1 in 4 internet users have looked at a rating site specifically about a doctor. But very few people, only about 5%, have posted a review. So one thing that I wrote about that is telling health professionals, Judgment Day is coming and only a few people are sitting on the bench. So I know that there are some doctors who are trying to get their patients to sign something saying that they will never post a review on them online. And, of course, that's just, frankly, kind of ridiculous. It's something that people can do anyway and will do. So the question is, we know that there's interest. We know that there is not a lot of participation. And so what I would challenge people to ask is, how can we make it better?
Bob, what do you think? Yeah, please.
I'll follow up. There are a number of companies out there that are now providing rating services. RateMD being one of them. And I was surprised when I first went on there, being from West Virginia, I suspected that local doctors would not be reviewed very much. And I was pleasantly surprised by the amount of rating that was going on by patients. So I think that's an interesting development. There has been some backlash, as Susanna had mentioned, not only by physicians themselves. There's at least one lawsuit that I know of that's happening out in the San Francisco area over a rating, I believe, of a chiropractor on
and
Yelp.
By the way, that's on Yelp, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one that we're watching. The other one that Susanna mentioned, the entrepreneurial other side, which is a company called Medical Justice, which is developing some templates for physicians to contractually ask their patients to sign away their rights to comment or make comments on these types of sites, along with some other rights. I think it's similar to what we watched a number of years ago with the Rate My Professor kind of initial backlash over that, and all the. And my understanding now, that's pretty fully developed now, and is allowed to that two-way communication back and forth and the commentary. One of the issues that physicians have put up in response to these types of rating sites is the fact that because of some of the privacy restrictions, they're not able or not capable of responding in any fashion to false information or inaccurate information. And so that's another argument that's being developed in the case involving Yelp.
Do you think a good argument could be made that those gag order type physician patient agreements are illegal?
Certainly. I don't know how well they have been tested or whether they have been tested, but certainly that's going to be one of those situations that arise, whether or not you can contractually, whether you're put in a position where you've signed it, it's not knowing, you're going to make all those traditional arguments that you would make in that sense. The other thing I'll point out is there are a number of ratings going on. I just saw yesterday where I think the federal government, CMS or HHS, issued report cards for hospitals where you can go on and obtain information. And that already exists for nursing homes and some other providers. So we're going to see more and more of that from a government standpoint, along with just from the individual patient perspective.
Great. Well, before we wrap today, I just want to go around to each of you and ask if there's anything else you want to cover that we haven't covered that relate to any of the topics we've discussed today or anything else that's on your mind. Doc, you want to lead off for us?
Sure. I guess that, you know, the briefest way of putting it is I think it's still very early. I want to say one thing about ratings real quickly since that came up. I can't stand them. I think as long as you have something that's centralized, I've seen so many cases where somebody gets sandbagged or a restaurant gets sandbagged. I think Yelp has become almost entirely untrustworthy because of that. I think that as soon as you centralize that kind of thing, and as soon as you're asking people to rank something that is essentially unrankable, there's either failure or success in many cases. I'm not comfortable with that. But again, I think it's an intermediate stage. I think we're trying out lots and lots of things that we'll learn from. But again, it's very, very early. And I think it's especially early in respect to where healthcare is going to go in the U.S. In a data-rich world.
Isn't it interesting, too, how Yelp has, you know, it started out for restaurants and it has become this place where people rate their doctors and the shop down the street and everything else? I mean, it seems like there is this desire to have a centralized rating clearinghouse and that users on Yelp are trying to make it that. But you're not trusting that whole process, huh, Doc?
No, I think that people will enjoy, there are going to be people who will enjoy gaming whatever can be gained, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we saw it with AOL, we saw it with CompuServe, we see it with Facebook now, which I think is AOL 2.0. It's, you know, as soon as you have these centralized places where people think, oh, I can like do stuff here, they do it, you know, and there are too many people still, they have one bad experience at a restaurant or one bad experience or they think is a bad experience with X, Y, or Z, and they crap all over it, and then that sits out there for, you know, N period of time. I saw it happen with the public radio tuner. You know, it came out. We said, look, this is version one. You know, this is iTunes, right? This is something where You come up with a piece of software, you can revise it every 10 minutes and continuously improve it. And that's what we've been doing with this piece of software. But yet lots and lots of the earliest reviews said things like, oh man, public radio, that blows. I'll give it one star. You know? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you get. You know, you'll see on iTunes, lots of things where there are 12 four-star reviews and 500 one-star reviews. And most of them are just idiots piling on, right? So, and can Apple fix that? Are they motivated to fix it? No, you look at it and say, well, I'll discount all the jerks. But how useful is it really? You know, I mean, I think it's useful to some degree, but again, it's a system that hasn't been worked out. And I think ratings have been around long enough so that I think we see how poor in many cases they are. There are some cases where they're very good, I think, but in most cases, not most cases, but some high profile cases, they're not. And I don't blame some doctors for wanting to throttle some of that stuff because, you work your ass off and then, you know, if somebody comes along, they have one bad experience and they sandbag you and it's sitting out there in the net until the end of time with some private organization that may or may not be accountable. And then people say, well, information's free, then it's a big open and free place. Well, yes and no. It ain't worked out yet.
Yeah, I tend to trust, you know, if somebody has a serious beef with someone, if they do it under their own name and they do it under their own brand, so to speak, you know, if they do it on their own account somewhere as opposed to in a centralized location, as you're saying, then I tend to trust it more. Susanna, anything you want to close with before we wrap up today?
I guess the main thing that I wanted to highlight from our data is the demographics of just reminding everybody who's online and who is actively engaged in health. When we look at the definition of an e-patient, and that's basically an internet user who's ever looked for health information online, 85% of college graduates are e-patients, only 25% of people with less than a high school education. We're definitely seeing a increasing divide between who has basic access, who has broadband. One ray of hope is mobile access. We are seeing a really interesting trend towards populations that are typically offline now are adopting these mobile internet devices and are starting to connect to information. But there's also a mismatch between people who can take advantage of patient communities. For example, going back to the ratings conversation, I actually personally wouldn't trust a rating site myself to choose a doctor because I have some really powerful local listservs that I'm on of other parents, people with certain medical conditions or concerns. And I would trust my online community of people I know much more than I would trust some random rating. But it's who gets to connect to those, who has the access and the wherewithal and the engagement to access that, frankly, really powerful information.
I was just chatting with someone, an acquaintance, who is in the field of health kiosks. Are you familiar with these? Where I take it it's aimed at the demographic that you mentioned that is not typically going online for their healthcare information, but nevertheless has this need for some out of the office feedback from the medical profession. And the thought is they will place these things in airports and possibly in your place of employment, other public places. And you can go online and have an interaction about a specific healthcare issue. And I think even get a prescription. And have you guys followed this at all? And do you have any thoughts on whether this is good, bad, or indifferent?
I think the health kiosk idea it does sound like such an anachronism from the 80s, but I think it can be powerful if it's, for example, being put in a church lobby or, you know, somewhere in a community setting where people might not have internet access, but might be able to go and get health information. I've also heard some really interesting studies looking at bringing cancer information, for example, to barbershops and hairdresser shops, that, again, the idea that you kind of take the healthcare out of the hospital, take the healthcare, you know, take off the white coat and bring the information to people in the community where they are, I think is potentially really powerful.
Yeah, I like that aspect of the notion, but the part that scares me is, you know, you're sort of replacing a doctor visit with a visit to some sort of community facing computer. And I just don't know, you know, what the quality of care you can expect to get out of that kind of interaction.
If it's anything like how people interact with health information on the internet, then it's not a replacement. We've asked that question multiple times, asking people, so when you did the search, was it instead of seeing a doctor? And we don't see evidence of that. It's people go online and maybe would have gone to this kiosk to get supplemental information. If people have a problem, they still want to see a health professional. That's something that really came through in this study that isn't changing, that the number one source of health information in the U.S. are health professionals. Number two is family and friends, Dr. Mom, frankly. Number three, it's the internet tied with books, printed reference materials, still rival the internet in terms of where people want to get health information. So we're not seeing evidence of replacing seeing a health professional, whether it's a doctor or nurse or whoever you can get access to.
Well, great. Bob, any last comments from you?
Yeah, just to follow up on, I think on that point on the health kiosk, you know, the interesting thing that has been developing over the last few years are retail clinics and pushing down to a different level of provider, to physician extenders, to nurse practitioners. And I think that some level of that to make the system more efficient and to use traditional physicians in a better role and to have some lower level services, I think makes a lot of sense for the future of our care in the United States. One of the concerns, just in closing, you know, we're in an exciting time and a frightening time for healthcare. There are a number of things that are coming together that, you know, I always say this is, I think it's the most major issue that the United States faces for its future success. We have the growing baby boomer population who's starting to move into that that era of using more healthcare, coupled with the rising cost. I just saw a report here in West Virginia that health premiums from, I believe, 2001 through 2008 rose 91% for individuals and families. Those factors are playing in and whether or not we're going to be able to afford care. And at some point, we're going to face issues of making decisions whether we provide care or don't provide care to certain categories of people, with the uninsured or the underinsured. So, and it's an exciting time. I think it's a time for innovation, a time for disruption in healthcare, and I think we're starting to see pieces of that. But we've got to solve some of these problems from multiple directions. I don't think there's one solution. I think there need to be multiple solutions that go to reducing cost, improving care, and making better quality.
Well, the reason I asked you all on the show today is because of the great work you've all been doing toward the ends of innovation and disruption in healthcare. And I really appreciate that and your coming on the show to talk with us today. So thanks, Doc. You can find Thank Doc you. Searles online in any number of places, including on Twitter at DSearles. Pleasure to see you again.
Oh, good to see you too. I'm not sure when I'm on and I'm not. So yeah, thank you.
You're on.
And I'm always on.
You're always on. And Susanna, you can find at the, is it pewinternetlife.org?
It's just pewinternet.org.
Pewinternet.org. Mm-hmm. And as Susanna with an H, Fox, on Twitter.
Yeah.
So it's been great to have you on. Really appreciate
Thanks.
Your insights.
Thanks.
And Bob Caulfield, also at Bob Caulfield, C-O-F-F-I-E-L-D, on Twitter. And you can check out his blog at thehealthcareblogla.blogspot.com.
Thanks a lot, Denise. I'm glad we finally, after a year talking about this, finally got it on the show. So I appreciate
I'm so glad too. I really appreciate your help in putting this show together. I've wanted to do it for some time. So folks can find me if you want to email me. I'm denise@twit.tv, and you can find me at dhowell on Twitter and on FriendFeed. And thanks to all for tuning in to this episode of This Week in Law. We'll be back live on live.twit.tv on July 31st at 11 a.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone. See you then.